The U.S. President Joe Biden and his predecessor Donald Trump have both passed the delegate threshold to grab their respective party's nomination. The phrase that seems to be reverberating in the lead-up to the U.S. presidential election is, democracy is on the ballot. Now, winning election is important, but it is also just another beginning. Now, 8 months out, what do polls indicate? And of course, most importantly, what comes next? For further insights, we connect with Professor Kim Byung-ju at the Hankuk University of Foreign Studies. Good morning, Professor Kim.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us and braving you. These waters, these tricky waters.
We'll try.
All right, we'll certainly try. In Korean media headlines, the number two topic closely following those of the April general elections here at home is about the upcoming Biden-Trump rematch, what people are calling a sequel to the 2020 election. Now, several polls have indicated that Trump may have the lead. What is your understanding and prediction for the November election?
Right. When we talked about this before, we were talking about the, you know, possible anti-Trump coalition, knowing that, you know, when Trump was first elected, nobody really realistically expected, but this time that there will be a strong anti-Trump coalition. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, what happens probably is, I mean, we're talking about this because, as you mentioned in the headlines, they're talking about Trump's surge and the polls indicating the strength of Trump. We're talking about the other side, you know, trying to give a balance to this and why some people may think Trump's victory is not given at all. And again, as we are being reminded, it's going to be really neck and neck, really tight, you know, race.
Right.
And we're saying that because on the other side, not only anti-Trump coalition, but also one of the things, I think the key thing here is money. U.S. politics is a system where it requires enormous amount of money. And as we know, as a result of Supreme Court ruling back in 2010, there's no limit in terms of how much money can be contributed to a certain candidate through a super PAC, and in total, how much money can be spent. There's no cap. And it's like a black hole for money, U.S. presidential campaign is. So basically what we need is understanding that you need really tremendous amount of money in order to run your campaign as we go forward. Your problem is on the Trump side, because unlike Biden, Trump has the legal fee issue here. He faces multiple, so many different kind of legal cases in the court.
91.
And, right. And he, as a businessman who's very sensitive about the money, he has kind of set up his system in a kind of a smart way so that his campaign fund will be actually used for his legal fees. And that a lot of observers see as a real kind of another black hole of money. They're sucking up lots of money away from his campaign. So Trump needs not only the money to run his campaign, in addition, he needs money to pay his lawyers in multiple large number of court cases he needs to deal with. So basically, he has a serious problem in terms of, and he has a much greater money demand on and then also supply of money. The collection itself seems to be kind of running short behind Biden. So November is, in political calendar, political watch, it's a long time ahead. It's a long journey ahead, and you need a lot of money. But talking about money as a possible problem at this point itself is a problem. Uh-huh. And if I may add just one more thing on that, on the supply side, you know, we all would assume that Republicans are the Republican supporters are the ones who have lots of money. Yes and no, but at the same time, you know, one of the traditional sources of campaign money, like a Koch brothers, there were Koch brothers. One has passed away, so it's difficult to call them brothers anymore. But there's a Koch industry, you know, company that these brothers used to own together. And they formed one of the largest super PAC called Americans for Prosperity Action. It's called AFP Action in short form. And this is one of the most important source of money for Republicans. But this AFP Action continued to support Nikki Haley until the very, very last minute. And so this indicates that business, the Republicans supporting business as a whole, are not really excited about Trump, because Trump is all about unpredictability and uncertainty and all that. So businesses don't like Trump, but if they have to, they will support Trump. If because if they want to stick with Republican, they'll have to support Trump. But they're excited about it. So there's that supply side as well. It's a very telling case about what was happening on the side of Coke industry and AFP action.
There's, like you said, maybe a lot up in the air with 8 months, given a political calendar indicating potentially more changes to come. But here's what I came across The Economist this morning on the Trump-Biden rematch. Quote, "The election will be less a popularity contest than a referendum on which man Americans think is the least bad option." So that seems there seems to be consensus around that. Not a
Right.
lot of people are excited about the Biden-Trump rematch.
Well, it sounds like Korean politics here. Anyway.
The ongoing saying has always been "In muri opta," there's no person to vote for. I wonder what that says about the current state of democracy. But another day, another discussion.
Right. Let's talk about that another day.
Okay, Professor Kim. So with the scenario of Trump's victory, there is a great interest in how dramatically he will potentially replace a professional in the U.S. government. What do we expect on that front?
Yeah, that's a really serious issue. I have friends that I talk to in Washington, people working in U.S. government and have worked in U.S. government. This is a real concern, because these are the people what's that are called establishment, the professionals who run the government, who make policies, right? And they're the real brain of so-called the United States, and they're called establishment, and they're criticized as with this another negative name, deep state, the people who actually run the country. I would recommend for those listeners who have time to read books here, Michael Lewis, the famous kind of mega seller, very famous
The Harvard
writer.
professor.
He wrote the famous books like Moneyball and The Big Shot, Big Short. Those books that he wrote became famous movies. But one of the lesser known but still equally important book by Michael Lewis is The Fifth Risk, that came out a few years ago. And this book describes how Trump struggled with kind of reshuffling and replacing professionals at the departments of energy and agriculture and commerce. The thing is, these professionals who are not really partisan at all, but still they didn't go well with Trump's lines, policy lines. So Trump wanted to remove them, according to Michael Lewis. And there was a much struggle. And then what's happening is Trump is painfully aware of this struggle against the establishment. So they're saying when he comes in back in T2 this time, he will really work hard to replace these professionals. The question is, with whom can he replace them? That is a real question. It's a big puzzle out there. He will, in order to have the run government the way he wants. According to Michael Lewis, Trump could not really run the government the way he wants, because he could not replace everybody or at all levels of the government, and he really struggles with it. She struggled with it last time, and how he's going to do that is a big, big question. And my guess, and then the guess of many people, I guess, is that he may have to face the reality where he cannot really re replace everybody at all levels of government, and he will have to find ways to work with the establishment. So there is a little bit of kind of a relieving perspective there in terms of practicality of his desire to replace everybody in the government. But at the same time, there's a scare about his determination and his trauma of having to work with the establishment in the past. So a lot of people are nervous at this point, including my friends in Washington.
Mr. Trump has also very openly vowed to fight crime, boost domestic energy production. But here's, I think, the kicker: tax foreign imports, end the war in Ukraine, and resume this America First approach to global affairs. So naturally, we start raising questions about what the potential Trump return to the White House might do to global order or his stakes in the American stakes in South Korea. And many
Right.
commentators have offered their outlook for Trump's policy towards the two Koreas. Can you give us some updates on those points?
Recently, we hear the experts talking about Trump's possible line for dealing with two Koreas here. One with North Korea, they're saying, North Korea is actually desperate about getting something out of their nuclear weapons position. They have increased their capability so much. And not only using it as a method of deterrence or force, they also want to cash out. They want to get something out of it, and possibly engage in what they want, what's called the dearmament or arms reduction. Not dearmament, but arms reduction talk. We have this much nuclear weapons. Let's sit down together and talk about how we're going to reduce arms on both sides. And by doing so, they want to get something in return. And there is a much expectation for that right there. And some of the watchers are saying Trump actually may be tempted to go to that table and talk with Kim Jong-un altogether, even though he'll be much more cautious than last time, especially after what happened in Hanoi. But there is a great temptation on the side of Trump trying to make a deal with North Korea, not necessarily denuclearization of North Korea, but like reduction of threats and all that kind of stuff. So that seems to be what many observers are seeing at this moment in terms of Trump's North Korean policy. South Korean policy, of course, what's widely talked about is Trump will probably try the same thing again like last time, trying to increase how much South Korea is paying for stationing of US troops. As we discussed before, South Korea is already paying for half of it, but if Trump asks for 5 times the increase of that, that means Trump wants to make a big profit out of keeping US troops here inside Korea, sort of like a running business or something like that, mercenaries or something like that. But that's going to be a big risk. And then there's a chance that he will talk about troops pull out in return. If South Korea doesn't come along agreeing to pay more, he will threat with possibility of pulling the troops out. But the thing is, experts are now saying it's clear that if US pulls out troops from South Korea, it's going to really, really negatively interest US interests because there's a Taiwan factor. If China tries something on Taiwan, if you don't have your troops in South Korea, you're basically naked in terms of like exposure to the threats to North Korea, from North Korea as well as China. So if because of Taiwan, you have to keep your troops in South Korea. That's what experts say, but we'll have to wait and see how Trump administration, if that ever comes into place, deals with it going forward.
Professor Kim, observers have also pointed out nuclear weapons issues for the two Koreas will gain greater attention. To what extent do you think, and what are the primary concerns?
It's interesting that two of the kind of noted names in Washington made this comment recently on this one, on nuclear weapons. First one that came out, I guess, recently is a Victor Cha academic, Georgetown, longtime Korea expert. He mentioned that Trump could actually be indifferent in terms about the possibility of allowing South Korea to go for nuclear armament, South Korea obtaining nuclear weapons, because Trump will be kind of conscious of the cost of maintaining troops, as we discussed here. And so instead of a costly option of maintaining US troops, why don't you guys, South Korea, why don't you have your own nuclear weapons? And so that's an interesting observation coming out of Victor Cha's observation. He's been always against the idea of denuclear, against the idea of South Korea obtaining nuclear weapons and all that kind of stuff. He has advocated full denuclearization and everything. So that's an interesting change of perspective, kind of accepting the possibility that the United States accepting the idea that North Korea is a nuclear state and there's a way to balance North Korea against it. Maybe US might have to allow South Korea to acquire its own nuclear weapons. So that's a very interesting scenario, and coming from that particular commentator is a very interesting case change of the situation. In addition to that, recently I also read Richard Lawless. He's one of the leading expert on Korean Peninsula nuclear issues. He served George W. Bush administration as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Asia, and he was part of a six-party talk delegation for the United States. He recently wrote a book about it, Hunting Nukes, and it was one of the important books that came out recently about Korean Peninsula nuclear issues. And what he says is that denuclearization of North Korea, which has been the goal of United States and South Korea for decades, nearly for 3 decades, is no longer realistic. He says, there's no way, absolutely no way, North Korea will denuclearize itself, and therefore new options need to be sought on this side. And I think that's a really critical thing, because if anyone, Richard Lawless is, will be one of those people who would have advocated full denuclearization of North Korea until the very, 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 very end. But now he's changing his mind, and there's a chance that Mr. Lawless could actually join a Donald Trump administration if Trump gets elected. So that's quite interesting. Then what he says, to deal with the fact that North Korea will never denuclearize themselves, one of the options that we can try on this side is actually having U.S. nuclear weapons here in South Korea to make South Korea more secure. So for those Koreans who care about the security of South Korea here as the top priority, that sounds like a reasonably attractive option in comparison to the current situation right now.
And Professor Kim, our final question today. In Korea, increasingly we hear opinions and perhaps ways to call for preparation for Donald Trump's return to the White House. So, what are your thoughts on this? As you alluded to, it's perhaps widely expected that Trump might ask the South Korean government to pick up a bigger bill for stationing troops right here, but that's just a beginning.
Right, it is indeed. And I hear people in private sector, for instance, what can corporate sector do in terms of getting prepared with the possibility of Trump coming back here, even though they are aware there's equal possibility for the Biden government to stay in place. But they're saying, what can we do? Can we find partners to talk to and stuff like that? One challenge here is that Trump government, if it comes back, it's a government that doesn't really rely on like a business basis or intellectual basis that they rely on. That whether it will be based on Trump's own thinking, and then also based on some of the populists' kind of populist ideas and slogans. So the thing is, the channel we can talk to is very limited. That's a real challenge, right? It's just unlike Biden administration and other Republican government on the other side. There were channels we can talk to, but this time it's very limited here. And so that's a real challenge at this point. And so in terms of how we can be prepared, I think, of course, the experts should be prepared for all different kind of scenarios at this moment. But it's time to think about fundamentally shifting the way we communicate with the U.S. audience, keeping in mind that U.S. audience this time, the nature of it will be very different from what we have dealt with for several decades and what we learned from the previous T1 as well. So it's a time for really hard thinking coming up.
Expect the unexpected is probably not what our listeners wanted to hear, but that's the summary.
Right.
Thank you very much, Professor Kim, for your insights. We'll speak to you again next week.
Okay, thank you.
If you're listening to our program using the podcast service, just a reminder that we do go live Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. Korea Standard Time. So tune in and help us make the show more informative by giving us your input. See you bright and early on Good Morning Seoul.